Hello, everybody. Welcome to the second day of FrostCon 2019, or FrostCon 14. I hope it's okay that I do this in English, because the talk will be in English. I hope you had a good night and are fresh and are very interested to hear something about privacy concerns, because GDPR hit us last year, and there's a big field that a lot of people are scared about, even if they consider privacy as a good thing. But to be compliant can be a nightmare or not. Well, this will be the talk that Yannis is giving you. GDPR and e-privacy, compliance nightmare for open source projects, because that's, yeah, you know that open source projects are much harder to control than other projects in a lot of directions, because you don't have this very strong structure. Well, Yannis is in the field of open source stuff since a lot of years. He worked in context of Mozilla for 6 years and was with Fedora for 9 years, which sounds like a very long experience in the area. And well, I'm very happy to have him here. Have fun.
Thank you. Guten Tag, and thank you for coming, despite it's still quite early in the morning. In this presentation, I'm going to provide an in-depth introduction to the most important, to the most fundamental organizational and processing requirements of the GDPR, which generally isn't a very easy thing to do, as the GDPR is one of the most complex pieces of EU legislation. It does span across 88 pages and includes 99 articles. So it would be impossible to cover every single aspect of the GDPR. We would be focusing on the key aspects instead. In addition, I will be doing a brief comparison between the main focus areas of the GDPR and the current e-privacy directive. And I will also be mentioning some important things about the upcoming e-privacy regulation, which is expected in the coming year, only in the coming years. So let's begin with a brief introduction to the GDPR. The GDPR was published in its finalized form in April 2016, and it became fully applicable from the 25th of May 2018 onwards. There was, therefore, a 2 years grace period under which we would have expected most organizations, at least, you know, the colossal organizations, to be fully compliant with the requirements of the regulation. However, it's been more than 1 year since the regulation was put into full effect, and a lot of organizations, both colossal organizations and also smaller entities, have no idea what their legal obligations are, and they haven't performed the consequent changes to their business activities and processes. The GDPR replaces the previous directive for privacy protection, for data protection, which was Directive 95/46, which I believe was no longer adequate if we take into account the vast advancements we have noticed in the ICT world the last 20 to 30 years. While the GDPR is a very good thing for EU data subjects, as it empowers them with additional controls over their personal data, and it also provides the harmonization of data protection laws across the European Union, the GDPR is a regulation, which means that it's legally binding and applicable to all 28 EU member states. Okay, maybe it's 27 now. Who knows what's going to happen in the coming months? Whereas EU directives are, let's say, guidelines that need to be followed by EU member states and then also need to be transposed into national laws. So while the GDPR has some benefits for the users, for the data subjects, and also provides us with a harmonization of data protection laws across the European Union, it still brings a lot of nightmares to smaller organizations and especially open source projects. On the one hand, we have colossal companies who have lots of money and resources and can probably afford, if they want to determine their legal obligations and perform the subsequent changes to their processes. And on the other side, we have smaller entities, we have small and medium-sized enterprises, open source projects, who are still supposed to comply with the extensive legal and technical requirements, but are, however, lacking the proper resources. And another thing, of course, is increasing awareness around privacy data protection matters, so that at least we should proceed with the minimum changes that are required, with the bare minimum changes. In any case, the GDPR may impose harsh penalties to perpetrators who are found to be incompliant, which can go as high as 20 million euros, or it could equal to amounts as high as 4% of the annual global turnover of a company. So, Article 4 of the GDPR provides us with the essential terminology that is being used throughout the legal text of the GDPR. Personal data is any kind of information that can be correlated, that can be linked to an identifiable natural living person. Names, home addresses, email addresses, mobile phone numbers generally, even location data, for example, when we have mobile phones that transmit the GPS coordinates of their users. All those examples constitute personal data. In addition to, you know, the generic form of personal data, there are also the special categories of personal data, which can be, for example, medical records, biometric data, genetic data, participation in trade unions, political opinions, religious beliefs, and so on and so forth. And the GDPR has additional safeguards for the processing of special categories of personal data. Now, processing is an umbrella term that refers to any kind of operation or set of operations that apply to particular pieces or even sets of personal data. The collection of personal data, the recording of personal data, the alternation, the modification, the destruction, the deletion, everything pretty much, every possible action that can be performed on data and on sets of data constitutes processing. The GDPR has three main categories of actors that are referenced throughout the entire legal text. Data subjects are the natural living persons. We are data subjects. They are the natural living persons to who personal data refer. Data controllers identify the purposes and means of data processing. And data processors, like the term suggests, process data on behalf of controllers. Now, in order to help make this a bit easier to understand, imagine there is a boat, and inside the boat, there is the captain of the boat, who is in the context, who would be in the context of the GDPR, the data controller. He or she gives orders to the crew members, and then you have the crew members who execute the orders of their captain, and the crew members would be the data processors. However, in the context of the GDPR, an entity can assume both the roles of a controller and the processor at the same time, depends on the case. And there are also some cases when two or more controllers can jointly determine the purposes and means of data processing, and therefore we call them joint controllers. More information on the classification of controllers and processors later on. The GDPR, admittedly, has a very wide scope of application. There is the material scope, which is described by Article 2, and it pretty much does not make any distinction between automated and non-automated processing. So even if we take pieces of paper and pencils and write down personal data manually, it's still considered to be processing. The good thing about the material scope is that it provides a few exemptions. For example, if data processing activities are done for purely personal reasons, let's say in the course of household activities, then such activities are exempted from the scope of application of the GDPR. So it's definitely okay to maintain address books, to have your contacts without the need of obtaining consent or, generally speaking, adhering to the extensive requirements of the GDPR, as such an activity is accepted from the scope of application of the GDPR. And in addition to the material scope, there is the territorial scope, which involves establishments within the EU which subsequently process personal data relating to EU residents. And in addition, it can also include establishments outside of the EU as long as they provide goods or services to people, to data subjects within the EU, regardless of whether a payment is required. And this is where a lot of open source projects can potentially fall into the scope of application of the GDPR. Open source projects that are established outside of the EU, that is. So moving on. Now, the organizational requirements. Here are some of the most fundamental organizational requirements, which apply, let's say, to the whole organizational structure of an entity that processes personal data. There are the principles of data protection by design and by default under Article 25, which pretty much tells us that controllers and processors should handle personal data and they should protect personal data right from the start, and they should also apply the highest levels of available protection. Article 30 obliges both controllers and processors to maintain records of processing activities. More information on maintaining records is about to follow. Article 32, titled Security of Processing, obliges both controllers and processors to implement appropriate technical and organizational measures to ensure the ongoing confidentiality, integrity, and availability of personal data. Generally speaking, the GDPR does not recommend particular measures, with a few exceptions, for example, the encryption and pseudonymization of personal data, but generally, it's not being very specific with regards to the actual measures that need to be implemented. It's up to the entities, it's up to the organizations to determine what needs to be done and what needs to be avoided. If personal breaches occur, the controller is supposed to notify the respective data protection authorities within 72 hours, if possible, from the moment that a particular data breach has been observed. This is a requirement by Article 33. And there is also Article 34, which in some cases may oblige the controller to additionally notify the affected data subjects. But generally, when it comes to Articles 33 and 34, there are specific conditions that apply. In some cases, for example, when there is a systematic monitoring of data subjects on a large scale, for example, when there are CCTV cameras in the premises of a company, etc., or, for example, when there is processing of sensitive personal data, the special categories of personal data we talked about earlier, then the controller might be obliged to perform an additional assessment called the Data Protection Impact Assessment. There are methodologies out there for conducting such an assessment. It is my personal estimation that most, I'm not saying all open source projects, it is my personal estimation that most open source projects do not need to perform data protection impact assessments. But don't take this for granted. It really depends from case to case. It depends what kind of processing activities are actually taking place. And in some other cases, there might also be the need to appoint a person called the data protection officer who oversees all the data processing activities of the organization that he or she represents, and generally provides recommendations. The last two obligations are covered by Articles 35 and 37, respectively. Again, don't take my word for granted. It really depends from case to case whether an entity needs to perform DPIAs and also needs to appoint DPOs. Article 5 provides us with the principles behind the lawful processing of personal data. It does say that personal data need to be processed in a lawful, fair, and transparent way, which, if you ask me, it's something very unclear. What does fairness mean? But anyways, there are some principles, such as the principle of purpose limitation, which asks that personal data are processed for specific and legitimate purposes, and they are not further processed for additional purposes which are incompatible with the original purposes they were initially collected for. The data minimization principle tells us that we should collect the minimum amount of personal data needed for a particular and legitimate purpose, and we should not be collecting additional pieces of personal information if they are not needed for an actual purpose. Accuracy tells us that we should make sure that personal data are accurate and up to date. Storage limitation sets an expiration date, let's say, on sets of personal data, and we should be discarding sets of personal data if they no longer serve any purpose. And as we have already seen before, controllers and processors need to ensure the ongoing integrity and confidentiality of personal data, which is also a requirement under Article 32, the technical and organizational measures we talked about. Article 6 establishes 6 different legal bases under which processing can be considered to be lawful. The most common of them all is perhaps consent. You know, we have users that sign up for a service, that sign up for a website, for an account, and most of the times, you know, there's a sign up form, there is a checkbox always. They tick that checkbox and indicate that they consent to the processing of their personal information, of their personal data. But consent is only one out of 6 possible legal bases that an organization can rely on. So there is a wrong misconception that consent is the only way for the lawful processing of personal data, which is a very wrong misconception. There might be a contract between 2 parties or a contract among more than 2 parties, and this contract could ideally include clauses about data processing activities and also sections about the protection of personal data. And therefore, a contract may be able to govern the data protection, the data processing activities that take place. An entity, an organization, might be processing personal data because it has to comply with a legal obligation, which doesn't affect a lot of projects, doesn't concern a lot of open source projects. Processing may also be lawful in order to protect the vital interests of a data subject whenever a data subject is unable to freely provide consent. An organization might be performing public tasks, such as the administration of justice, which, okay, doesn't concern all open source projects, I would say, either. Not just most, but all open source projects. But again, don't take everything for granted. And last but not least, there is the principle, the legal justification of legitimate purposes. Legitimate purposes are perhaps the most flexible legal base of them all. And organizations can rely on legitimate purposes for a variety of reasons, as long as they do it in a reliable and justified manner. For example, keeping security logs can be done without the consent of data subjects. Because entities, organizations that process personal data have an obligation under Article 32, called the security of processing, to implement the technical and organizational measures, and therefore can rely on legitimate interests. It's in their legitimate interests to protect their online infrastructure. It would also be impossible to request consent. It would be very hard, not impossible, but very hard to request consent from users in order to store IP addresses. It would be chaotic. It could be chaotic if you think about it. So what we should keep from this is that consent is not the only way of processing personal data in a legitimate way. There are six legal bases in total that we can consider, as long as data processing activities are done in a lawful manner and are meanwhile compatible with the rest of the requirements of the GDPR. Data subjects are empowered with a set of rights. A lot of these principles already existed in the previous Data Protection Directive, but are now further reinforced with the GDPR. When communicating with controllers and processors, data subjects should receive transparent information using easy-to-understand language, plain English, plain German, and so on and so forth, without the legal jargon, without many technical details, so that everybody can understand what's going on without the need to be technical literate or, you know, to be knowledgeable about legal procedures, legal jargon. So data subjects have the right of access, which isn't just about receiving a list and the descriptions of the personal data that an organization holds on their behalf. It's about receiving actual copies of their personal data. And yesterday I read that a German court, I do not remember which court exactly, actually reinforced the idea of having decided that, yes, data subjects should receive an exact copy and not just lists with descriptions. So I believe that this was a very important decision, and it's going to play an important role in the future exercising of the rights of data subjects. The right of rectification provides data subjects with the possibility of requesting a change, a correction of their personal data in case something is not up to date or is not accurate. Data subjects have the right to erasure, also linked to the right to be forgotten, which is in turn linked to the Google Spain case, if you are aware of the Google Spain case, which I believe was a very important milestone for the establishment of the right to be forgotten. So pretty much under specific conditions, you have the right to ask for the deletion of all your personal data from a specific organization. Again, there are a few exceptions to this. Depends on the case. In some cases, data subjects may also have the right to request the restriction of processing of their personal data and also to object to the further processing of their personal data. And last but not least, and very importantly, it's very important nowadays because we have seen the rise of cloud computing, data subjects have the right to data portability. Pretty much controllers are expected to be able to export personal data in under machine-readable formats so that users, so that data subjects can freely move from one service provider to another service provider. Okay, so this is a visualization of the organizational and processing requirements we have talked about in the previous slides. I have already actually, somebody else actually uploaded the slides for me on the website of Froscon. Everything is available under Creative Commons, so you are free to take in-depth looks later on. Now, a few things about compliance assessment. We talked about maintaining records of processing activities. What do they mean? There are a few guidelines out there. For example, there are some guidelines set by the Working Party 29.
And generally speaking, here are a few things that you need to consider when maintaining, when creating and maintaining records of processing activities. First of all, it's for sure that you need to provide a friendly name for the processing activity which is involved. Just a name that can help you quickly identify for which processing activity you are talking about. You need to specify the controller or the controllers that are involved with this particular processing activity. Likewise, you need to do the same for processors, for any processors. Your description should mention what kind of data processing activities are taking place, exactly what is done, what kind of activities are performed on the sets of data. It should briefly mention the data flows within the infrastructure of your company. It should mention who has access to those particular sets of data. It should also justify why those particular people have access to the sets of data. And it should mention also the storage method. Where are the data sets being stored? Is it inside the file cabinet? Is it in your online infrastructure, your offline digital infrastructure? Where is it located? Does it use a combination of storage methods? You have to be specific about where the data is stored and what happens to the personal data inside your organization. Also, what kind of data are involved? Is it personal data? Is it special categories of personal data? Or is it a combination of both? What about the legal justification? Is there any legal justification at all? If there is no legal justification, then most likely processing is unlawful and you need to reconsider your data processing activities. Security measures. What kind of particular security measures are set in place to protect the personal data involved in this specific processing activity? Do you believe that those measures are adequate for and provide a reasonable protection? What about the processing principles we talked about earlier under Article 5? Is everything processed in a lawful manner and in a transparent way? And last but not least, what about the data subjects? How can they exercise their rights? Are there any mechanisms in place for, let's say, obtaining copies of their personal information? How do you handle data subject requests? And when it comes to running an organization-wide GDPR assessment to determine those things that we talked about earlier, where mostly, I mean, the records of processing activities mostly take into account the processing activities themselves. Now, when running organization-wide GDPR assessments, here are 4+4 basic questions that you can ask yourselves in order to help determine a basic compliance level within your organization. I'm not saying that this is an exhaustive list. It's definitely not an exhaustive list, and there are a lot of factors that may additionally need to be considered from case to case. But these are nevertheless 8 basic questions that you can ask yourselves. So first of all, does the organization fall under the scope of application of the GDPR? Is it established in the EU and processes data that relate to EU residents? Is it based outside of the EU and meanwhile provides goods or services to EU-based data subjects? What's going on here? If an organization is neither based within the EU and is not offering goods or services to EU-based residents, then perhaps it's not affected by the GDPR's scope of application and there isn't anything else that you need to do about it. I mean, GDPR does not apply to you. But it is my understanding that most open source projects generally fall under the GDPR's scope of application, and you need to acknowledge all the organizational and processing requirements of the GDPR inevitably. Because most open source projects have a very global outreach. There will be a Q&A part in the end, and please write it down. Thanks. Thanks a lot. So, what about the roles of the organization? Is it a data controller? Is it a data processor? Is it a combination of both? Or is it a joint controller with another organization? Has it implemented appropriate technical measures to protect their infrastructure in generally? Does it maintain records of processing activities? If yes, are they regularly checked and up to date? Has the organization published a privacy policy? Now, the GDPR does not mention anything about having privacy policies, but there are articles 13 and 14 which expect the controller to inform data subjects whenever personal information has been obtained from the data subjects themselves or from another source. And generally speaking, having an easy to understand and comprehensive privacy policy is the de facto thing to do. More information on drafting privacy policies is about to follow. Does the organization embrace the principles of data protection by design and by default that we saw earlier? Does it protect personal data right from the start, and does it provide the highest available levels of data protection? Has the organization published procedures for data breaches? Again, the GDPR does not specifically ask for procedures for data breaches. However, there are several requirements that need to be taken into account. And again, it's a very nice thing to have an available procedure for handling data breaches, which can be very helpful in under stressful situations. Again, as a reminder, Articles 33 and 34 oblige the controllers under specific conditions to inform the data protection authorities and the affected data subjects whenever they experience a data breach. Last but not least, does the organization in question need to appoint a data protection officer? If yes, has the organization appointed one? What are their roles and scope within the organization? And now is the fun part, let's say. With cookie consent banners, I am sure that a lot of you swear in front of their computer screens every time one of these banners pops up, and some of them are admittedly very annoying, but they are what I call a necessary evil. This particular implementation is very much unethical and is not compliant with the GDPR. It does not let data subjects, okay, I think that it can be observed pretty well. So it does not let data subjects witness what kind of information are being shared with the website, what kind of information is being collected by cookies. There is a hyperlink, I'm not sure if you can see that, there's a hyperlink which says more info. If you click on that hyperlink, most of the times that I have seen, it just redirects you to the privacy policy of that particular website, which happens to be a poorly written privacy policy as well. There is a next button next to the that's fine button, which is ironic. Nothing is fine with this particular implementation. There is a next button. If you click on that button, nothing happens. You don't actually reject the installation of cookies into your web browser. You just choose to ignore that annoying banner. Again, this is a very much unethical implementation and is not compliant with the GDPR. If you do know somebody who uses such kind of cookie compliance banners, please tell them to opt for a more sophisticated solution, such as this. I am not saying that you should go ahead and implement this particular solution, but this is a very nice and very sophisticated solution, which is compliant with the regulation. It lets users see exactly what kind of information is being shared with the website in question, and it lets them opt in for the additional processing of their personal information. So please do not choose cookie consent banner implementations like this one. Please go for something like this instead. A very important thing, if your web platform only stores session cookies, then you don't need to obtain consent. You need to inform your users that, you know, your website installs session cookies on their browsers, but you don't really need to obtain consent. So keep that in mind. I see a lot of websites that are just installing session cookies on people's browsers, and they put cookie consent banners, which is unnecessary. Now, when it comes to sign-up forms, I hope you can see what's going on. So there is a sign-up form on the left, which is not compliant, and there is another one on the right, which is compliant. As you can see, the sign-up form on the left forces users to additionally sign up for the newsletter, besides, you know, accepting the terms of use and privacy policy, which is an unethical and incompatible practice with the requirements of the GDPR. Whereas on the compliant form on the right, there are two separate checkboxes, one for accepting the terms of use and privacy policy, and then there is also another one for optionally subscribing to the newsletter. Furthermore, if we ask for additional pieces of information, such as phone numbers, we should justify why those additional pieces of information are needed in the first place. Here, for example, we ask for the phone number of the user. On the form on the right, you might notice that there is a small section under the text field which says that inputting that particular piece of information is optional. If the user chooses to share that information with their website, it can be used to send the user text messages with verification codes for two-factor authentication purposes, etc., etc. So we make sure that we justify why those additional pieces of information are needed. Now, privacy policies. It is my belief that we should refrain from using privacy policy generators. It's okay to draw some inspiration from their generated texts, but it's most of the privacy policy generators out there produce insufficient privacy policies which do not cover aspects in detail. A privacy policy should explain exactly what kind of processing activities are taking place. It should explain how data subjects can exercise their rights. It should provide them with an option. It should reference how can data subjects submit complaints at their respective data protection authorities in case their data subject access requests are not sufficiently handled. So again, I would recommend not choosing privacy policy generators. It's okay to draw some inspiration, but if you don't feel very comfortable with producing a privacy policy on your own, then you should probably ask somebody else to do that for you. Don't just go ahead and use privacy policy generators without drafting a sufficiently written privacy policy. Now, I'll be describing some things about the current e-privacy directive, which was published in 2002 and was later amended twice. It was amended once in 2006. This particular amendment caused a lot of protests, sparked a lot of interest among advocates, digital rights organizations, as it did introduce data retention practices by telecommunication providers, which was later declared invalid in 2014, if I'm not mistaken. And there was another amendment in 2009. So the e-privacy directive has a much more specific focus than the directive for data protection and now the GDPR. It does have a more specific focus. It focuses exclusively on traditional electronic communications and involves, generally speaking, telephony, internet service providers, and email service providers. And among its focus areas, its key focus areas, are browser cookies, unsolicited communications for marketing purposes, user tracking, etc. But one of the major flaws, let's say, of the current e-privacy directive is that it doesn't concern alternative communication options, telecommunications options. So it does not concern over-the-top communications, for example, such as VoIP services, streaming services, instant messaging services, which is exactly what the upcoming e-privacy regulation wants to fix. And additionally, the e-privacy regulation, the upcoming e-privacy regulation, is expected to influence machine-to-machine communications as well, especially among IoT devices, where we don't have any modernized pieces of legislation covering communications among IoT devices yet. And very importantly, it's going to be a regulation. Like we said earlier, regulations are applicable and legally binding to all 28 minus one EU member states. Whereas the directives need to be transposed into national laws and therefore does not provide the same level of harmonization across the EU member states. Furthermore, the e-privacy regulation may additionally involve non-personal data, such as data relating to legal persons. Remember that the GDPR is about personal data that relate to natural living persons. And in a broader term, we can safely assume that the e-privacy regulation will be lex specialis. It will specialize into specific matters, such as the matters we have seen in this slide, whereas the GDPR will retain its much broader scope of application. It will be lex generalis. Now are a few additional resources that I would like to share with you before closing the main part of this session. There is the GDPR checklist at gdprchecklist.io, which is also published under open licenses. I don't remember the particular license, but everything is posted on GitHub. So the source code of this particular website is publicly available under an open source, free and open source software license. And this particular website provides an intuitive way of being informed about the most important organizational and processing requirements of the GDPR. Pretty much what we have seen throughout this session in a comprehensive and laid out manner. And there is also GDPR Tracker at gdprtracker.io, which compares well-known internet services in terms of their GDPR compliance efforts. Just a reminder that my slides are already available on the website of Froscon, so you can have a look at any time you want. Everything is available under Creative Commons. Now, here are also a few links about the GDPR and lean data practices, which is one of the most recent campaigns launched by Mozilla. You know, Mozilla has been very much advocating for data protection and privacy for many years now. And with our recent campaign about lean data practices, we recommend that companies should process the minimum amount of personal information needed and should perform appropriate measures in order to safeguard personal data. Not just because it's the ethical thing to do, but also more importantly, because it's a good thing performance-wise. So that would be all for now. We have ended our main part of this session. We will now proceed with the Q&A session, which I have asked not to be recorded online and generally on video. And I'm doing this because the GDPR is a very complicated legal text, and it generally cases may vary one from another, and I don't want to be responsible for sending wrong messages to online viewers. So you are free to ask questions. Please understand that there are several factors that need to be acknowledged, so I might not be available to answer your questions adequately in under 1 or 2 minutes, let's say.